From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, Texas songwriter and musician Joe Ely talks about his music, his career, and his newest release that he recorded 30 years ago.
In those days, we never dreamed that you could ever fit one whole song inside a computer, you know.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. It was still a mostly analog world in 1983, but it was a year of great strides in bringing the digital age into the home. The birth of the World Wide Web was still 6 years away, but 1983 saw the arrival of America Online, Microsoft Word, and a little plumber named Mario at the Quarter Arcade. But it was also the year Steve Jobs gave us Apple II. Texas rocker Joe Ely got one and had the crazy notion to try to use it to make music. The resulting album was pioneering and revolutionary, and it sat in Ely's archive until today. Joe Ely sat down with Texas Public Radio's Nathan Cohn to discuss the now-released CD, Before 84.
Before 84, it's kind of like a precursor or an early version of your album High Res.
Yes.
And this album, I think, really sounds great. But what was it at the time that you think that your record label, MCA, was not hearing? Or why didn't they want to release this?
Well, you know, it was kind of just the times, you know, in early 80s. I was just coming back off the road from being literally on the road about 7 or 8 years, constant, nonstop. And that was a time when I first signed with MCA, and I did the first three albums with them. Were, you know, had a lot of West Texas sound to it because I was living in Lubbock, and then there came a period that I found myself touring all over. Like not only the United States, but over in Europe too, with lots of different kind of bands, like with The Clash, and mm-hmm. with we played some stuff with Elvis Costello, and I was getting a lot of different influences just listening to, you know, when you're traveling, you're always finding new things. And at the end of 1982, my guitar player just quit on New Year's Eve, and we were all kind of tired, and I said, you know, I think I'm just going to take a break too. And I just took a year off. And during that year, I started going through my notebooks and finding these songs I had written on the road, and started just experimenting with putting them together. And got my friend Mitch Watkins, a great guitar player, and Roscoe Beck, a great bass player, who we set up a little four-track tape recorder, and I had a little rock room. And I had just gotten an Apple II computer and really didn't know what to do with it. It was this complete foreign object. And I had a little, the very first sequencer before MIDI, you could play notes in it, and it remembered the notes, you know. So it was kind of like, and then I had this old Roland drum machine, an 808, which was brand new at the time. And me and Mitch just started seeing, just for the fun of it, seeing what we could do with this stuff. And a couple of months went by, and we started listening to it and said, wait a minute, there's something kind of interesting going on here. At the end of the year, the record company said, well, it's time to start a new record. And I said, well, wait a minute, we might already have the record. But they didn't think so, so we ended up at the beginning of, first half of 1984. We actually went to L.A. and re-recorded the whole record using real drums and big studios, and had went to Warner Brothers Amiga Studio and lots of engineers and everything. And it was so kind of funny for us to watch this giant thing come out of this little bitty mm-hmm. record, you know, little small record, although there was something about it we really liked.
Well, you know, it doesn't sound, you know, dated also. I mean, it doesn't sound like necessarily like it was 1983 or something. I mean, it sounds modern. Well, I'm curious also how you use the Apple II, because nowadays, I mean, you can fit an entire studio on your iPhone, right? But you must have had to use like floppy disks, and I'm wondering like how long it took to render the sequences.
There was no such thing as rendering.
Right, right.
It didn't have enough memory to render. So. And I don't know if you saw the record, but on the liner notes, we actually sent the record to Steve Wozniak.
Yeah.
And I had talked to him back in the 80s about what I was doing. And he said, oh, yeah, I know the guy that made that sequencer, the keyboard that fits inside the computer with a couple of cards. It had a piano-sized keyboard and then a whole bunch of cards that plugged into the slots.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yeah, I know that guy. I worked with him on, you know, he said, because the Apple II had an actual input and an output port. He said, but in those days, we never dreamed that you could ever fit one whole song inside a computer, you know, because the memory would have taken, you know, what the Defense Department had at that time. So.
Well, you know, your website says that you've been online since, I'm holding air quotes right now, online since 1983. I mean, where did your interest in technology come from?
From that first computer.
So that was it, right there.
I had no interest whatsoever in technology before, even though in Lubbock I knew some guys that were, you know, computer guys from Texas Tech that were also musicians that were friends of mine.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Joe Ely on Texas Matters. I'm Nathan Cohn. Let's pause for a moment and hear one of the songs from Before 84. This is called What's Shakin' Tonight.
What's shakin' tonight? What's shakin' tonight? Hey, pretty baby, what's shakin' tonight? What's shakin' tonight? What's shakin' tonight? Shaking tonight, slap on some rouge, show your tattoos, put on your long gone high heel shoes. There's a moon out tonight, you're looking just right. I feel like messing with a dynamite. What's your shaking tonight? What's your shaking tonight?
Well, this album contains like one of the earliest versions, I guess, for release of a tune that a lot of people love of yours is Cool Rockin' Loretta.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so when you go back and you listen to this version of it or some of the early versions of some of these songs, I mean, how do they sound to you, you know, with the way they've been worked over the years?
Yeah, and that's a great example, Cool Rockin' Loretta. The version on this Before 84 record is the very first version of it. It's been re-recorded live and on different records many times, but this was the very first version. And so it, when I took it out and played it, it sounded so fresh because it was kind of the, my friend Eddie Beethoven had come down from Lubbock and he had written the verses of it. And we played it and played it and played it, worked on it all day long, a couple of days. And it, the verses were great, but it just never seemed to let loose. And then I came in one morning and just suddenly a chorus just opened up that says, my, 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 ain't she fine.
Ain't she fine.
And so that was kind of like, you know, a missing piece. And then we got Mitch over and recorded it. And then all got around and sang harmonies. No, we only had a four-track machine, so we had to do that old thing from the Beatles.
The Beatle bounce.
Yeah, the Beatle bounce. And I think we finally got seven or eight tracks out of it and were able to double-track our harmonies. Just, it was mainly me and him, and I think Roscoe was singing the high parts.
If you're just joining us, this is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. My name's Nathan Cohn, and our guest today is Joe Ely, whose new album is Before 84. a new release of unissued material from the early 80s. Let me go back a little bit further. You know, I read about how you saw, as a young man, Jerry Lee Lewis perform, and I guess you were like 6 years old. And is that one of your earliest musical memories?
I guess the earliest memory is singing in the First Baptist Church choir, mm-hmm. you know. There was always a piano in our living room, although nobody played it in my family. And I think it was left over from my grandmother, who liked to play the piano. But I used to pluck around on a piano and just see what kind of melodies. I was always interested in melodies. And then when I was eight, that whole thing of seeing Jerry Lee Lewis kind of stuck in my head, and I just wanted to play some kind of music. And there was a violin maker that was a friend of my family's, and we used to go to his house and have Sunday dinner. And he would be building violins out in his shack in the back, and I remember watching him build a violin, and later on my parents had him build me one. And between all of those things at a young age, I just followed music, and I played in the orchestra. And then when I got to Lubbock, when I was about 11 or 12, Buddy Holly had just died, and every kid in Lubbock was playing a Stratocaster, you know. And so that kind of, the violin got put in a case, and the Stratocaster got plugged in.
Well, when you decided, hey, I'm going to pick up a guitar and start working on songs and melodies myself in this regard. You know, one of our listeners was asking about the sound of Texas music and the way we have a sound here in Texas and how it's characterized by kind of playing a little bit behind the beat, kind of in a pocket, you know. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you heard and developed by listening to others? I mean, how did you come to get your sound like that?
I think it was a combination of a lot of things. It was mainly for me, probably growing up in Lubbock had a lot to do with it, because at that particular time I met all the musicians in Lubbock that I would know later on in life. And a lot of those guys played so good because there wasn't much else to do there. You know, there was a couple of places to play, but it wasn't like a mecca because it was a dry county. But there were honky-tonks way on the other side of town out by where there was a strip of liquor stores, and the honky-tonks were all out by about 15, 20 miles out of town. So a lot of these musicians played out there, and I used to go out and listen to them sometimes through the back door when I was too young to get in. But anyway, that was kind of the places where everybody played, and that's where I got to meet some of the guys. Some of them had played with Holly. So I got to see this whole kind of evolution go from the country stuff into the early rock and roll era, when I think probably because Johnny Cash and Elvis came to town in about 1954, I think, and Buddy Holly had seen them then. And that's where his sound kind of changed from bluegrass into rock and roll.
Do you think growing up in Lubbock also contributed to endless days and on the road and touring, a kind of wanderlust? I mean, did the environment of being in that part of the state kind of contribute to your desire to get out and go?
There was that horizon, that Lubbock being so flat. We always reckon that because that horizon was out there and it was 360 degrees, we all wondered what was on the other side of it. I kind of grew up, my granddad worked on the Rock Island Railroad in Amarillo, and my dad worked on the Santa Fe. And so I kind of grew up taking trains with my parents and grandparents. So I got to see a little what was on the other side of that. But it was really in high school when I kind of discovered Woody Guthrie and the songs that he wrote about West Texas, and then finding other songwriters. And I started being curious about where songs came from. And that was when I met Butch and Jimmy and the became the Flatlanders, and they were already experienced songwriters, but they really had a big influence on me wanting to write a song.
What was it that you saw in them that, you know, rubbed off on you, that you that you took from them?
Well, they were able to keep a song in the scene, the setting of West Texas, but make it interesting, mm-hmm. you know. And all of a sudden, I looked at West Texas differently. Before, I'd looked at it as kind of a flatland desert, you know, richland desert dust bowl, you know. Nothing real inspiring about it. But then Butch would play a song about that same wind and dust, and all of a sudden it would be colorful and work perfectly in the song, and you could relate to it, or I could relate to it.
Even those experiences can be universal for many people, even outside of living in that area.
So people, you know, were, when we would play those songs to someone else, they'd say, "Wow, that's a nice song." Mm-hmm. And it would paint a picture of some place completely different from where they are.
The stars in my life don't shine like sunshine. If only I can see your smiling face. Though this universe collapses on occasion, the stars in my life.
So I was able to all of a sudden see a way to put songs together that I would feel comfortable with, that kind of were in the setting of wherever I was, say in West Texas or whatever. And they would take me away too. I could play them and I could go somewhere, just travel and play in them myself.
Let me ask you about the lyrics of some of your tunes, you know, because some of your songs feature a lot of lyrical tension. There's wild characters, you know, even on this album on Before 84, there's Lipstick in the Night, and you have a whole album called Love and Danger.
Love and Danger.
Yeah, I mean, so let me ask you about the lyrics and some of the characters in your songs and ask you, you know, how many times have you ever been in a jam yourself that kind of well, led its way into these tunes?
I have been in quite a few jams and a few jails too. So, in fact, in the Lubbock jail in the late '60s, I got thrown in jail for just having a few little colorful mushrooms and a few little cactus plants. But you know, that was an experience. I remember hearing Merle Haggard. They had a radio in the jail cell, and Merle Haggard was singing Branded Man, mm-hmm. and that was popular at the time. And that was kind of like I wanted to get out and sing a song like Branded Man, because I had been in that situation, and I something told me I kind of had to sing my way out of it. And then, of course, being on the road a lot, I ran into a lot of characters that were seriously frightening characters that sometimes came into the songs, kind of desperado drifters, you know, that Texas was always a place where people came when they were running from the law back in the old days, because it was so big that you could hide without even being behind something. You could hide just by being there, you know. So I guess reading, Woody Guthrie, listening to his songs you know, outlaws and desperados, and sometimes he painted the outlaws as being the hero, like in Pretty Boy Floyd.
Yeah, yeah.
He says, you travel around this country, you meet some funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun, and some with a fountain pen.
You'll never see an outlaw take a family from his home.
And that's the closing verse. So you know, that all that interested me, because I could see that there was something romantic about that. About, I kind of rewrote the history of Billy the Kid and Bonnie and Clyde, and I always like to take history and kind of rewrite the ending of it, you know, and because in my Billy the Kid song, we never did get along. And so all of those are myths that grow over the years. And songs are a great place for myths to begin, because it's they're like little movies.
Made Billy the kid, never got along. Didn't like the way Cocker's had me, wore his gun all wrong. We had the same girlfriend and he never forgot it. She had a cute little chihuahua till one day of him shot it. We rode the hard country down the New Mexico line. He had a silver pocket watch and he never did whine. We could pull a piano player and play his favorite song. Had me and Billy the kid just never got along.
That's music by our guest Joe Ely here on Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. Some other listeners wanted to know about your work with The Clash, about when you first met them, and, you know, what was the common ground that drew you guys together?
Yeah, I met The Clash in late 78. Our band found the first couple of records, especially the second record, Honky Tonk Masquerade, didn't get much play around the United States or Texas, but started climbing up the charts in England. And so we found ourselves being asked to come over and play the big festivals over in England, Ireland, and Scandinavia and Holland. And while we were doing a sound check in London, one of the people from the club came back and said, "There's some scruffy young gents that would like to meet you." And I said, "Yeah, bring them on back." And it was the Clash in 78, which they were pretty scruffy at the time. But they had a hit on the radio that was written by a guy from Lubbock, a guy named Sonny Curtis. And the song was "I Fought the Law and the Law Won." And it was huge in England. And they had heard on the radio that I was from West Texas, from Lubbock. And they liked my song about "She Never Spoke Spanish to Me," a few things from Mexico. And come to find out, they came in backstage and we started talking about music. And they offered to show me around London after the gig was over. And so we got our band and their band and went out on the town. And we just had the greatest time just hanging out, seeing the town from the Clash's point of view. Mm-hmm. And we had about a week and a half that we were in England just doing interviews and stuff for the record. And so every night we'd go out on the town. And we got to talking about things that we had in common. I liked Garcia Lorca, the Spanish poet, and Strummer liked Marty Robbins' ballads like El Paso and Streets of Laredo and all these songs. And so we kind of had this strange thing in common, even though we grew up on different sides of the ocean. And when I got back to West Texas, I got a call a couple of weeks later, and it was Strummer saying he wanted to, if I could arrange for them to put a tour together in Texas, because they were coming to the United States for the first time in 1979. And so very few promoters knew who they were, but somehow we managed to put shows together for the two of us in like Houston, Laredo, El Paso, Lubbock, Wichita Falls, these places you'd never go. So they actually got to see Texas, which was a bit disappointing to them. They thought it still had swinging doors and you tied your horse up, you know. And they were amazed at Lubbock at how wide the streets were, you know, because in England it's little bitty two-lane streets, and in Lubbock it was like eight lanes, you know.
With few cars,
but they were still terrified to walk across the street because the street was so wide. And also terrified that once you got out of the city limits that there was nothing, that it was, you know, 80 miles to the next gas station.
You're in the middle of the wilderness.
So it was great to have that experience of showing them around West Texas after they'd showed me around London. And couple of years later, they invited me to come up and record Should I Stay or Should I Go with them. So that was, you know, it was kind of a cultural exchange program that was great fun. It was one project we had talked about doing that I wish we could have done. We were going to go down into Mexico and use studios and bands down there and record a whole record together. Never got to do that, but it kind of taught me a lesson, like when you say you're going to do something, don't put it off.
well, speaking of, you know, you wrote this book, Bonfire of Road Maps, which is a collection of verse and drawings and musings of life on the road. And you have been working on a novel, Super Reverb, a while back that I've been reading about for a few years. And now it is going to come out.
Going to come out. Michael Ventura, who writes the letters at 3 a.m., started his own little press. And he's some of the people that he knows. In fact, a few from West Texas are writing books that he's going to publish later on. Mine's looks like it's going to come out about the 1st of October. And we shortened the name to just Reverb.
Okay.
It's kind of a novel that takes place in that years of the late 60s, kind of when the Vietnam War was on and all the music was coming together from different parts of the world.
Well, the last thing I wanted to ask kind of brings everything together. And when we talk about technology and songwriting and, you know, future efforts as well. And you know, it's easier than ever now for artists to record and release their own material. And I might just ask, you know, what advice you have for young musicians who have to navigate both music and the music business nowadays? And as an artist now, what does it mean as far as records and labels and self-promotion?
Well, in a way, it's, you know, when I was growing up, there were no tape machines anywhere. You know, if there were, I think there was one in Clovis, New Mexico, one in Lubbock. It was very expensive to keep a tape machine running and all. But now, of course, everybody's got a multi-track recording studio in their back pocket. Mm-hmm. So now the problem is not finding out how to record, which is what we always try to do, but finding out what to record and how to listen to yourself. And people now, there's so much music and they're so bombarded and they listen to so much that they don't know what to say themselves, you know, because they have so many influences. We used to listen to the same record like for months at a time, you know, because that's all we could afford. So I guess the thing is you have to really, sometimes you have to turn everything off in order to hear what you really want to say.
Well, Joe Ely, thank you very much for your time today. I really enjoyed it.
Well, all right. I had a great time coming up here to San Antonio and talking about all this stuff. I hope you got a little out of it that your listeners can relate to. It's a long, interesting process to finish a record and put it out.
That was Texas music legend Joe Ely speaking with Texas Public Radio's Nathan Cohn. Ely has a new release, an album he recorded in 1983 using an Apple II computer. It's called B484. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org, and you can write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us on iTunes and tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.